18th.
Tuesday the 18th. We have three bills in front of us this morning. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 224. We have, I think, what do we have, some amendments on that?
Mr. Chair, we have the Dash 2 Amendment. You will recall that this is a bill that deals with the Northwest Wildland Fire Protection Agreement. That is an international treaty which has been ratified by Congress and the other states participating. The concern that was expressed in the last meeting was the language that when the compact or when the agreement is changed, the legislature shall review the changes. Members wanted stronger language there that clearly indicated that the committee, that the legislature must ratify the amendment, and in the interim between sessions, the emergency board must review the changes for the state to continue participating.
Do we all have copies of those Dash 2 amendments? I don't see the other copies.
I don't, and I usually do here.
We brought you in a separate packet.
There they are, right there.
I'm sorry, did you have...
And I usually do.
On the front of it, there's a staff measure summary, and
there's one to the back. I've got the staff measure summaries, but I don't have the...
Okay, here's the Dash 2 amendments.
Yeah, I've got the summary, but no amendments.
As you remember, this was Representative Hill's, and he's not going to be with us here this morning for a while. This was his issue of...
Representative Thompson needs one?
I could use a second, but
I just gave them away.
We're looking at page 4, section 4, about the governor invoking Article 10. And Article 10 is where we withdraw. Would you like to come on up? And it looked like there was kind of a gap in there because it said if there was an amendment, then actually until there was an agreement, we would even invoke Article 10 and we would withdraw from the agreement until such time as Legislative Assembly reviews. And so I think what we were trying to do was put some language in there so that we don't withdraw it and we can go on. Until we give an opportunity for the legislature doesn't meet every 2 years, that now it would allow the emergency board to review, and then at the next regular legislative assembly, then give them an opportunity to ratify. Have you seen these amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Charlie Stone, Assistant State Forester. That's my understanding of what the amendments do. And
does that look good to you?
It looks good to us.
It looks like it gives an ongoing flow to the whole thing without having the Legislative Assembly caught in that timeline of reviewing there.
That's my understanding, Mr. Chair. As long as the Department of Forestry reports the change to the agreement to the Emergency Board to review it, then it would continue in force until the... until the legislature fails to ratify it in the next regular session.
Everybody up to speed on what we're doing here? This was the concern of Representative Hills that only the Legislative Assembly under the current language in Section 4 would be doing the reviewing. And, of course, that leaves a timeline problem there. It could be up to almost a year and a half.
Yeah, you can do it.
Everybody have the amendment?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, are we in work session?
Yes, we are.
I've moved the Dash 18 amendment from the Senate Bill 224.
Yeah, thank you. Everyone comfortable with what we're doing? Yeah. Any discussion? Anyone opposed? Adopted the Dash 2. So now we
can move the Senate Bill 224 as amended to the floor of the DUPAC recommendation.
Any discussion of the motion? Samantha went up.
We're still waiting
Was the other bill that we're working on conflict amendments or this bill here?
670, she's going to get conflict amendments on that one.
So we're okay with this in here. Okay, go ahead then, Harrison.
Wells?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Uberlau?
Excuse.
Beyer?
Aye.
Hill?
He's excused.
Deckard?
Excuse.
Hobson?
Yes.
Krupp?
Aye.
Trumbull?
Aye.
Well, Senate Bill 24 is passed and will move to the floor. Anyone interested in sharing that?
Sure.
You deal with firefighting. Representative Beyer will carry. So we'll close the work session on 224, and are we ready to go on 670?
We can certainly start. We have, let's see, we got this amendment very late, so I'm going to have to walk through her material here and hand it out to you.
Okay, we're going to hold the work session on Senate Bill 670. Thanks, Charlie.
Mr. Chair?
I'm a city secretary.
Can you provide for me I'm not familiar with the term. I don't really know what conflict amendment means. What does it mean?
A conflict amendment is when you have amendment. You have two different bills going through the system that are amending the same section.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And if one passes, then it can cause a conflict with the other bill or whatever. And so you have to work it out so that even though maybe if both of them pass, it's all right. But if only one passes, then there's a conflict. And so then usually legislative council has some amendments to put in those bills so that those problems don't happen.
Why are we not there?
Great. Well, thank you.
What we have with 670 is a replacement bill. You'll recall that this is the bill where we...
Maybe you better sit down here, Harrison, so they can take you out. Did Senator Farrell, he didn't stay around.
Al Elfin just went to get him, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. As you remember, committee, this is Senator Farrelly's issue that about sunk to the bottom of the creek the other day. And the Marine Board had some real concerns, and also Division of Fish and Wildlife had some concerns because it would have made them deal with directly every case of criminal trespass and everything that came along, whether it was regarding to wildlife or not. And so we have now the dash ones, and there was a work group. Maybe Representative Beyer, you can tell us what you did.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the work group, we got together and we discussed the issue, and the first thing it was decided to take all the reference to the boating rules out of the bill because they didn't seem to really fit, and it really was kind of muddying the water, so to speak. So we took out the reference to boating and boating licenses, boating tags. We then set to work on the issue, and you'll see on the dash three amendment or the dash one amendments on page 3, section 2 of the new bill, to tie the crime to the act. And to do that, we defined what horn hunting and wildcrafting are, those two issues. And then we put in that when a person is convicted of violations of criminal trespass, mischief, and throwing objects at trains while the person was angling, hunting, trapping, wildcrafting, or horn hunting. So we're tying the loss of hunting and fishing licenses and privileges to actions that relate to those issues.
Mr. Chair, I have a question of
Representative Oberlaw.
What does throwing rocks at a train have to do with hunting, shopping?
Inside joke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Oberlaw, the reference to that is the statute 166, and that deals with discharge of objects. And we're technically throwing rocks at a train probably would qualify. I think it's a bit more like shooting a gun at a train. But anyway, that was kind of the where we went. But that we kept the same six or the same nine criminal offenses that is in current law, and we just basically we applied that wild crafting or horn hunting violations in those areas would also result in a loss of hunting and fishing privileges.
Representative Byer, we had some discussion last night about line 25, and is in there. So the person is convicted of those crimes, and also they have to forfeit bail before they lose those privileges. Is that meant to stay in there?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. That is, current language is not worded exactly the way that way, but it is meant, if you look on page 1, line 19 of the amendment, where it says the person is convicted of violations, and then pursuant thereto, who forfeits bail or otherwise fails to comply with requirements, the Legislative Council has changed that to and the person forfeits bail or otherwise fails to comply with requirements. So then the meaning is the same, in my opinion. I'm not an attorney, of course, but I read that meaning is the same as current law. It's just worded in a different way.
When we first looked at this, it appeared that all they have to be is convicted. That there's a little higher standard. They have to do more than just be convicted. They have to forfeit bail or otherwise fail to comply with
that
the requirements
correct.
Of citation
but that,
in order to lose their license.
But that's current law. And the only question I had in the work group, and perhaps Senator Farioli, I see, is here now. He can clarify that.
Come on up, Senator.
When we were discussing this, I had some concerns about the issue of criminal trespass. If just carrying a firearm and then being convicted of trespassing would result in being a criminal trespass, I didn't think that was where we wanted to be. Senator Farioli said he was going to research and make sure that you had to do a few other things besides just happen to have a firearm on your person. So I'd like to be clarified of that before we move forward.
So with that, committee, Senator Farrell, I think you heard some of the discussion. Representative Byer was part of your group. You've narrowed your bill down, and like you said, this wasn't a problem, this bill. This was an opportunity, and you've come through pretty well, at least to salvage part of your bill.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. Ted Farrioli, for the record. Representative Byer's question, the focusing of the bill connected the action of trespass with the specific action of horn hunting, wildcrafting, or actually angling, hunting, trapping, or entering onto the property of another person in pursuit of those activities. So I think that deals effectively with Representative Byer's question about if a person was in an urban setting, for instance, and was trespassing, even in possession of a gun, would that require the forfeiture of these licenses? And not unless they were wildcrafting, horn hunting, or angling, or fishing, or pursuing one of those other outdoor recreational sports that typically has resulted in some of the trespass activities that are so bothersome to rural landowners. I think that does deal with Representative Byer's question.
Yes. Representative Thompson?
I haven't, because I wasn't in the committee last week, apparently I hadn't been aware of this bill, so I have a lot of catch-up to do. And I guess I'm going to ask you some specific questions. If a person was to be angling in my country, where there is no fences and no line of demarcation, and you're to walk down through a national forest and then walk onto a private farmland or a pasture that can be, there's no indication of it, would you then be in violation of the law if you were to do that?
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Thompson's question, I think the district attorney would have to prove criminal intent. In other words, innocent or simple trespass is not going to get you prosecuted for criminal intent because there would be no evidence that shows that you intended to commit a crime while you trespassed.
In the case of, we have a lot of mushroom hunters in the national forest, if they were to go on to a piece of property that was privately owned, would that be a case of considered criminal intent when you're there for the purpose of harvesting mushrooms?
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Thompson, harvesting mushrooms on public land requires a permit. which you would get from the Forest Service, and they have maps and areas where they would orient the mushroom hunters to that information. Going off that property onto private land for the purpose of commercial harvesting would be an of trespass, because the permittee would be considered to be somebody that has a higher standard. They had to get a permit. They had to check in with a Forest Service ranger. They're supposed to know where the lines of demarcation are. So if they entered onto a private landowner's land, I think they could be cited for trespass. And if it showed that they did that knowingly, and that's the difference in standard, they'd have to know that they were on the other person's land for that purpose, then they could be...
Senator, what I want to do, because we really need to get on this other thing, I think I'm going to hold this bill over to Thursday. We're going to meet on Thursday again.
And that'll give everybody on the committee an opportunity
to look at these amendments, and I want to hear from Rod Harder and Al Elkins, too, on this before we move ahead.
Mr. Chair, before we get off this, though, this word of knowingly is going to come up several times in the next day in relationship to all kinds of things, and so I hope that we can have I'd like to have the legislative staff come in here and explain exactly what knowingly means and also what culpability means so that a layman can understand it, so we're specific, because this is paramount to several bills, not just this one in the legislature at this time.
Let's give everybody an opportunity to see the dash ones and work on here. And,
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Thompson's question, would it be to the chairman's pleasure for me to bring legislative counsel to explain the elements of criminal trespass?
It might be good.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have more time.
I'd actually just call them to come down, but we can call them off till
Thursday.
They'd probably like to be more prepared.
Right. Yeah. Let's carry this over. I'm going to close the work session on 670, and let's carry this over to Thursday. We have a couple other bills now that have come in, so we are going to be meeting, and that will give everybody a little more opportunity to work on this issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chair, just as a clarification, are we going to be working off of the -1 amendments or the -3 or -4?
The -1 and then the -3 conflict amendment. The -1 is what we're looking at.
So what's the purpose of the -4?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe that you do need the -3 and -4. We literally just got those 10 minutes ago, so I haven't read them, but they were provided to us as conflict amendments. So we will certainly review them and try to comment on them in our next measure summary, but I think you'll need them.
Evidently, the conflicts deal with... Another Senate Bill 20, is that what we're talking about here?
That's what it said, yes.
I think we all need to spend a little more time on this, so let's wait till Thursday and I'll give everyone an opportunity and gives an opportunity for Rod Harder and Al Elkins and Phil Donovan and all the people that are involved in this to take a look at it here, and then we'll have more time and more testimony. So with that, we'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 1212. We had this bill in front of us last week, as you remember, and had an extensive hearing on unpasteurized milk. Dealing with the basic bill, do we have an amendment that we want to talk about first?
Mr. Chair, we do. We have the -4 amendment, which was provided to correct drafting issue. It does not, in fact, address every example of that. If you look at page 3 of the printed bill, the -A printed bill, in lines 7 and 8, we have a requirement that milk be offered from cows. I'll start a little higher in the section. The subsection 4 says a distributor shall not sell or offer milk unless all of the milk constituents are from cows that were produced from a disease-free herd and have been pasteurized. It's not an and situation there. It has to have been pasteurized. The idea was we were getting rid of raw milk from cows. So what we have in the amendment is that we're getting rid of the language on line 8
were produced by disease-free herd and. So that it now just says, has been pasteurized.
Where are you at again?
I'm sorry, we're on page 3 of the clinic bill in lines 7 and 8.
Thank you.
Looking at an example here, the first example of a fix from this dash 4 amendment. What we're getting rid of at the end of line 7 is were, and at the beginning of line 8, produced by a disease-free herd and. So that now it says a distributor shall not sell unless all of the milk constituents have been pasteurized. That's what this amendment does.
What's the dash amendment?
This is the dash 4 amendment, not the dash 3. So it gets rid of that one in line 7 and 8. Below in line 10, it gets rid of the same phrase, were produced by a disease-free herd and. So that now it just says it has to have been pasteurized if it's from a cow. Now, what we do not have in this amendment that we need, if you go back to page 2, line 13, or actually it's line 15, you have the same phrase, from cows that has been pasteurized and produced by a disease-free herd. So we need to get rid of that, and produced by a disease-free herd.
We're going to do that
and that would be conceptual. Okay. Same phrase down beginning in line 18 and running into line 19, and produced by a disease-free herd. So that now a person shall not knowingly sell dairy product unless the milk and cream constituents are the product of cows that have been pasteurized. The product from cows has been pasteurized.
Should that be has rather than have?
No, I would assume that the tense is correct.
Milk or cream?
Mr. Chair, a question for Harrison. In regards to the second line, goats, in the reference to goats on line 20, why are we leaving in and were produced by a disease-free herd in that particular circumstance?
Well, number one, Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, number one, it is an or statement as opposed to an and. I think that there's never a circumstance where it has to be pasteurized and from a disease-free herd. The other distinction, you'll remember from the testimony.
Goats, it's not. We're not pasteurizing.
Right. You'll remember from the testimony that we still have one goat milk producer who sells raw milk, and we were going to allow that person to continue selling raw milk. So that's why the distinction in the treatment.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Byer.
Got to ask Harrison another question.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a minimum size on this, or I mean, is there a point in which a person can go buy raw milk from a dairy if he's got less than a certain number of animals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, we had some testimony on that, I believe, from the Dairy Association this last time. I think Ron McKay is here, and he's probably the best person to talk about that. I thought I remembered from Senate Bill 234 that there was some sort of an exception below three cows, but I'm not sure that's what you said at the last meeting.
As I understand, according to this bill, if you had one cow, you couldn't sell. You couldn't sell raw milk.
Well, maybe Ron McKay from...
Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Ron McKay with the Department of Agriculture. Three cows or nine goats. If you have less than that number, you are not required to be licensed.
I don't think licensing is the issue. Whether you can sell raw milk is the issue. Don't you like to come on up?
So, Mr. Chair, do you have to have a license to sell milk at all in the state?
We'll ask that question.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ron McKay. I'm the administrator of the Food Safety Division of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I guess to answer the question, a license is required to sell milk, as the law currently reads, to sell either raw or pasteurized milk. The proposal to change this is to remove the exemption for the sale of raw milk. The law holds producers who have less than three cows, less than nine goats, exempt from the licensing requirement. So a person can own one or two cows, they can be producing milk, they can use it themselves, They can give it to family members, that type of thing. No licenses required. They cannot offer that milk for
sale.
Are
we talking here about plant licensee rather than the producer?
Mr. Chairman, the requirement for licensing is both on the producer and on the plant. So a producer distributor, a person who is going to bottle, who is going to produce and bottle and sell raw milk from the location, is required to be licensed as a plant, as a producer distributor.
I think the question is whether the dairyman is licensed.
Okay.
That's the intent of my question, yes, Mr. Chairman.
If they have more than 9 goats, if they have more than 3 cows, they are required to be licensed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Byer.
Did I just hear him say that even if they have less than or 2 cows or less, they still will not be allowed to sell raw milk if this bill passes?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Byer, I'm not clear on the language of this bill as to whether that would exempt that or not. I had not read it for that language. I can't answer that question.
It's my understanding that they would not be able to. This would not allow them to have 1 cow and sell jug milk to your neighbor.
Mr. Chair, reading Section 5 through, as I just have, would indicate to me that this is a complete prohibition against any sales of pasteurized milk.
So I think with that, let's move ahead here and talk about a proposed amendment to this bill. So with that, Dave Nelson, proponents of this amendment, we have an hour. We have 10 o'clock floor, so we have an hour to work on this issue. And we'll let the proponents come up, and then we'll alternate back and forth with testimony.
Hey, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson. I represent the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and we appreciate the committee's willingness to hear the Senate Bill 1212A-3 amendment, which creates, and they're intended to create, an opportunity for Oregon to participate in a Western States Milk Marketing Compact, if such a compact is ever created in the Western States and ratified by the Congress of the United States. The testimony I've passed out, you've all seen in its yellow form, so it's nothing new, and I've spoken with all of you about the contents of that package, and until to the point I think you're probably all don't want to hear that again. So I would like to introduce Ralph Dyke, who's the president of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, and Mr. Bob Wellington, who's the senior vice president of economics and legislative affairs for AgriMark Co-op in Vermont, and has been right in the center of the New England Milk Marketing Compact, to give you the complete story of how the New England Compact came to be, how it has operated, and how it has affected both producers and consumers. So first I'd like to introduce Mr. Dyke, who's the president of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association.
Thank you, Dave. Mr. Chairman and representatives, my name is Ralph Dyke. I live at 9530 Northwest Roy Road, Forest Grove, Oregon. I run a small dairy there of 60 cows. On this Roy Road, there is about 4 miles in Washington County. When I moved on the present dairy that I'm on today, I moved on there in 1966. There were 16 dairy farms, 7 grade A, 9 grade B. Today, I'm the last of the species on that road. And this has been the trend in the state of Oregon for the past 30 years, but especially the last 10 years, we have taken a dramatic hit in Oregon. We have lost over 50% of our dairies. Our cow numbers are down from 120,000 down to 88,000 cows. Oregon is a milk deficit state. We are importing approximately 100 pounds of milk per person into this state to meet the needs of our consumers. Now, why is this happening? The reason this is happening is because of our cost of production. It has been going up constantly in the last 10 years, and I'm sure you're all aware of our labor issues, minimum wage, repairs, insurance, building costs, equipment, land, utilities, and the thing that's really been hammering us in the last 5 to 6 years is our environmental issues. And for dairymen to comply with the environmental issues on the western side of the state in Oregon is running approximately $1,000 per cow to get into compliance to do this. And that takes bucks. And I'm sorry to say we have no way of passing this on to the cost of our product that we produce. And I'm sure you're all aware of the fact that we are receiving today what we received for our milk per gallon amount that you folks are buying as consumers in 1991. That is where we're at yet today. And how we've been surviving is a very hard question. And that is why we have been losing so many dairies. You will hear later on about how their product has been priced up and down, or has been going up in the store to the consumer, and has been staying the same to the producers. Dairy farming in Oregon is a natural fit. We have a mild climate. We can produce the feedstuffs for our animals, for our cows very well, and we do have marginal lands in Oregon that the only thing we can grow on them is grass. The only other profitable crop is pot, and some people don't like us to be growing that stuff. But it grows very well in these marginal lands that are awful wet that we can't grow other crops on. We ask you to help us to save the dairy industry in Oregon by giving us the means of a profit margin like all other businesses have. With a dairy compact in place, it will help build a future for our sons and daughters to stay on the family farm or to start their own business. And in Oregon, we have been the number one in U.S. milk quality in the country. Our fluid milk sales in Oregon per person, we are number two in the country, and Utah beats us out as number one. We are proud of the product that we produce in Oregon. So help us save the dairy industry and save and have a healthy, viable industry. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. Wellington, we'll talk to you about the New England Compact, which is the only currently operating compact in the state of Oregon, or in the United States. It was authorized by the 1996 Farm Bill and has it was actually implemented, I believe, in 1997 and has had now 2 years of operation, and Bob can tell about that.
I appreciate the opportunity to come here. I was invited by the Oregon Dairy Farmers. We work with them on many issues on a national basis.
Welcome to Oregon.
Thank you. It's a long way. I'm actually a New Hampshire native. We have most of our members are in Vermont and the rest of New England, so it's quite a long distance. But I actually, when I drive around this countryside, I see many similar kind of countryside here in Oregon that I see in New England. Basically, I want to tell you how it operates as briefly as I can and why farmers in New England need it. And you can tell me if Oregon farmers have those same interests. So I don't know that, but you certainly do. Why the compact? Farmers are very conservative, free market-oriented people. And you say, why turn to the government on this kind of issue? Well, it's basically because the free market in milk really isn't free. If you look at milk production, it's very unique among most agricultural commodities. Milk is produced every day. It's you've been talking about, it's perishable. It needs to be pasteurized. It needs to be taken off the farm within a day or two. Farmers don't have a whole lot of price-making authority on the farm. In fact, most farmers don't even know their price until the month after they make the milk. And that applies in Oregon and it applies in New England. Also on the competitive situation, I'm not familiar with the marketplace here, but I can tell you in New England that the ratio of farmers to the people who buy their milk, the processors and the manufacturers, is larger today, meaning more farmers per manufacturer and processor than it was in the 1930s when the federal government invoked a lot of their kind of programs. Even though the farmers have gotten larger, the processors have even gotten larger. In New England, we have one processor now based out of Dallas that in the last 3 years have bought 8 of our 12 processing plants, and they produce, they manufacture probably 60 to 70% of the milk. And that changes our competitive situation dramatically. USDA, we've turned to in the past, that has not worked. They do have a federal order system, which is important. But that federal order system actually is declining prices to farmers. They made a recent decision that came out in March that would lower the price to farmers. I believe it would lower it here in the Northwest. I know it certainly would lower it in New England and in most other areas of the country, which creates a very severe problem. The price support program was a program that did work about 15, 20 years ago. However, back in 1980, that price was $13 a hundredweight. Today, that price support program price is $10 a hundredweight. I'm talking real money here, not, you know, adjusted for any inflation or anything else. And in fact, that program ends at the end of this year. We don't have that anymore. So we don't see USDA as a solution. They're part of it, but they're certainly not going to come to the rescue. And more importantly, we know we needed to look at local supply and demand conditions for milk. USDA cannot do that. Farmers cannot deal with that because they don't have the competitive strength to do that. So when we look at a compact, it allows states to get together in a region and look at the unique costs in that region. We can look at production costs there. We can look at environmental issues. If states decide they want to have stronger environmental regulations, that's a good way to pay that for that. You can do that through the compact and help on that situation. We can look at the competitive situation. Where are the other milk supplies? The compact doesn't stop a gallon of milk from moving into the compact state. Okay, but it limits the how much you could charge because that milk can come in. We have that situation. We have New York, which is the third largest dairy state in the nation, and Pennsylvania, which is number four, next to New England. So there's a limitation to how we can set the price because we can't stop the milk from coming in. And so we've tried to do that through the price setting mechanism and how we do that. I'll talk about just that briefly in a moment. The commission is a commission of members appointed by the six New England states right now. Each state has a delegation of 3 to 5 members. Most of our delegations are appointed by the governors. Some, though, New York's looking at it right now. They've already passed it on a state level. They have the legislature and the governors. A governor appoints one. The Senate majority leader appoints one. The Senate minority leader appoints another. The assembly speaker and then the assembly minority leader. So that's how they get their 5. Every state can do that differently. We have consumers on it. They're required, in fact. Farmers are required. I know some of your bill processors. And any time they make a price change, they have to have a public hearing. And in fact, when they make that price change, if a state doesn't agree with that price change, it doesn't have to apply to that state. This is not the majority rules or even the supermajority rules. Any state can exempt itself if it doesn't like that price. So a group of states cannot overpower one state and say, we're going to set that price for your consumers. And that was very positive in you. Because we have a problem in New England that we have little Rhode Island, and then we have Massachusetts. Massachusetts has 6 million people. You know, Vermont has 500,000 people. So we had to balance those things out. So no one can force someone else to do that. And our consumers run our commission, by the way. Our chairperson, our vice chairperson, and our secretary are all consumers, and they have been from the beginning. We've changed offices, but they've always been consumers. They don't have to be. But the farmers have agreed to that, too, because consumers have to agree to this issue. The third issue I want to talk about briefly is that the compact is a safety net. You're familiar with milk prices and where they've been. They've been a tremendous roller coaster. In fact, I have a friend who's a physics major in college, and he did an analysis for me and showed that you couldn't build a roller coaster like milk prices have been because it would defy physics. It's gone down and, you know, so much. It's been absolutely absurd. All the compact does is it takes the bottom out of that roller coaster. There was no payment to New England farmers for the last 7 months. The compact triggered out because market prices moved up. But, as all you know also, the price of milk collapsed this spring. It went down in March, 10 cents a gallon on the fresh milk side and 50 cents a gallon on April 1st. 60 cents a gallon it went down to farmers. So, I'm not sure, I can tell you, it didn't happen in our stores. Okay, particularly in New York and Pennsylvania where we don't have a compact, it did not fall hardly at all. I can talk briefly about that if you have questions on that. What our compact has done now, didn't pay for 7 months, now it's going to trigger in. And it's going to pay our farmers about $1.44 a hundredweight for the month of April. Our average farm size is smaller than yours. We run about 75, 80 cows. Although we have farm sizes, of course, that range from our hobby farm to 20 cows to our, 800 or 900 cow herd. An average size farm in our case will probably get $1,200, $1,300, which to a small family farm with no farm help or whatever is crucial. Because they're basically going to get nothing for the milk in the month of April. The month of April price was the same as it was in 1979, by the way. I'm glad to hear you guys only back to 1991, but I'm saying it goes back to 1979, and that's what happens to the roller coaster. It's fair to all farms. We don't have a problem with our farms, large versus small, because our small farmers realize they need our large farmers. Everyone needs the same payment. on a per hundredweight basis. There's no distribution more to anybody else because someone happens to be smaller or larger or whatever. It's a very market-oriented program. If you're going to liken this to a social program, it's not like welfare. It's not like food stamps for farmers. Okay, it's more like a minimum wage. If you work more under the minimum wage program, you get more. If you work 20 hours versus 40, or say 40 hours versus 20, you get twice as much payment under the minimum wage. Same thing in under the Dairy Compact. The last thing I want to talk about is impact on consumers, because I know that's most people's concerns, particularly legislators. And what we found out over the time period was we invoked this in July of 1997, as was noted. When that happened, the prices had fallen to a very low level in July of 1997, back to 1979 levels. So the Compact Commission looked at 1996 prices, which weren't as high as the last year, but they were fair prices, they thought. So they set the compact price at the average, within a penny a gallon of the average of 1996. Well, the price to farmers had fallen 35 cents a gallon by the summer of 1997. So they thought, oh, you know, the price to retailers hadn't fallen, so they don't need to raise the price. We'll just keep the price constant. They didn't pass it along. Well, the dealers got the notice and said, we like those higher profit margins we earned. You know, when the price fell to farmers, we could keep it up in the stores. And so they raised the price of milk about 20 cents a gallon in our stores when that happened. And they put big notices in the supermarkets, okay, that the money was going to dairy farmers. Okay, don't blame us. Okay. Well, in reality, that worked very well because we had no consumer complaints whatsoever in the newspapers to legislators or anybody else because the notices said that the monies went directly to dairy farmers. But competition played its role. That's before we had one person owning two-thirds of the market. At that point, the price of milk, our milk started going down. And, in fact, the final impact was probably about a nickel a gallon. Yes, it did go up. No denying that. It did go up probably about a nickel a gallon. We look at it, though, as we lose more farmers, it's going to take more than a nickel a gallon to bring that milk in from further and further distances. I mean, I'm never going to say here that consumers aren't going to have milk, whether it's in Oregon or New England. You've got to get milk, okay? But you're going to pay a price for it. You know, whether we have New England farmers that make it or we have more milk coming in from Central and Western New York or Ohio or Pennsylvania, farmers, you know, you're going to pay more for that. Whether you get your milk from Oregon or you get it from Idaho, which is a very rapidly expanding state, your consumers are going to pay more to bring it in. And we think it's better try to support local businesses. We have about 3,500 farms throughout all of New England, and not proportionally that much more milk than Oregon because your farmers are larger. But with those 3,500 farms, they're 3,500 small businesses, and they support a lot of other businesses, particularly rural communities, which need that kind of support. I have a publication. I'll leave one copy. I'm sorry I didn't bring copies of it. I can either send fresh copies or I'll leave this one with the committee. It's a report card we did of the compact. And when I did that, I looked at the milk prices around the country. There's a group called the International Association of Milk Control Agencies. And I don't know if Oregon is a member of that. I know Washington is, so we have Seattle prices. And in this, I have Seattle prices, which, by the way, are probably the highest in the country. It ran about $3.12 a gallon last spring, which are the numbers that we had. Our prices in Boston, by the way, were $2.69 in downtown Boston. So our price was about 50 cents a gallon, less than that in Seattle. Yet our farmers, because of our compact, were getting substantially higher, probably to the tune of 10 to 15 cents a gallon more for their milk. So, I mean, those are some of the factors that are involved in this. I mean, like I said, I don't want to say here that you won't increase the price, because it does in the marketplace. But it goes directly to farmers. And like I said, we've had very good reception from that from our consumer groups. And, in fact, I don't know if you have public interest research groups here in Oregon. I know we do out in, you know, MassPerg, we have DPERG in Vermont.
We have Osberg.
Okay. And they've been very, very supportive. The only public interest research group that hasn't been has been in New York State. And we think the reason for that is the founder of that group is also the lobbyist who was hired by the milk dealers to support that. So we never got a chance to go in there and explain our case. But the other PERGs in New Jersey and other areas have been very supportive of that.
I have some questions.
I'm done my
time. Yeah, let's get down some questions. How many states belong to your compact?
Six New England states.
And of course, all the legislatures in those states passed this legislation, and then Congress, when did they ratify your compact? That was done during the 1997 farm.
96 farm bill, and went into effect in 97 because we needed to set up a commission.
The grocery industry, distributor industry, what was their reaction when you started working on this in all your states?
They were neutral on it. They did not get involved on the issue. They wanted representation. In fact, we do have supermarkets representatives on the commission. There's two of them. One based out of Massachusetts, one based out of Connecticut.
Okay. Other questions, Mr. Mayor? Representative Krupp, and then Representative Cohen.
Since you invoked the compact, have you seen prices stabilize enough to the producer, the dairy farmer, that you've seen a reduction in the number of dairies going out of business?
We did in two of our states, Vermont and Connecticut. We've seen some positive changes because they also have a massive dairy farmers involved in those states. We haven't seen that yet in Massachusetts and Rhode Island, and that's primarily because they've gone down so far in the number of dairy farms that they've lost their critical mass. By critical mass, I mean enough farms to support the service agencies and large animal vet and feed dealers and equipment dealers and things. But we are in those states. We have seen some newer farms come on, particularly the younger generation. We have a problem in New England. Our average age is 58 years old of our dairy farming. I don't know what it is here, but I don't imagine it's probably far off from that. And so we've seen a new generation. So we've seen an attitude change. But 2 years is hard to do because it's only a safety net.
We could probably take an informal poll in the audience.
Yeah, I was looking out there.
Figure that out in a hurry. These might be the dads, and they got their sons.
they've got time to come to me. Representative Cromwell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that in April the farmers were going to be getting dollars back, and I assume that that's from the compact. Where does the compact get us dollars to pay the farmers?
Okay, it sets a price per hundredweight that the milk dealers who sell milk into the compact region have to pay. Okay, right now that's to the farm level. It's $16.94 a hundredweight. Okay, that was set by the commission in the public hearings. That $16.94 is then compared with the federal water price that exists in New England, and when that federal water price is below that price, it collects the difference. Okay, and the process is send that difference into the compact commission, who then send it back to the dairy farmers, directly to dairy farmers. The only other people who get money out of that, by the way, are the WIC program and the school lunch program to hold them harmless. But it collects that difference between the compact set price and the federal order set price.
Follow up?
President Crowell.
What happens then if the price of milk goes above the compact price?
Then the compact triggers out entirely. The compact is supposed to trigger out whenever the prices approach the cost of production. If farmers want to get above their cost of production, they ought to get it from the marketplace. So it triggers, once it's above $16.94, the compact hasn't made a payment for 7 months prior to April because the market was above that price.
And follow up?
President Crowell.
When you say trigger out, I assume that means that they don't collect any dollars.
Correct.
So then any time that the price is below the compact price, then the compact itself, that commission, is collecting from the producers.
From the processors. Right.
And then those dollars are held in an account and then paid back to the farmer.
It runs just like the federal order. In fact, the federal order in our area pays farmers for the month of April. They pay on the 20th of May, so in 2 days, and the compact commission will pay on the 20th also. It's an immediate return back to farmers.
Okay. Follow up. Has the federal order been terminated in your area yet?
Oh, no. It works very well with our federal order. In fact, the market administrator does all the auditing so we can keep the cost down. Processors pay the administration costs, because we want to keep that as low as possible because there are very tight limits on that. So, no, we work very well with the market administrators.
And one last follow-up. Mm-hmm. With regards to the federal order, if the federal order is higher than the compact price, then that's what the farmer is able to get for the milk?
Yes.
Thank you. Representative Obelaw and then Representative Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, you partially answered it, but I'd like to know how it worked. I was going to ask you, if you send all the money back, the difference, where do you get your money for administration of the commission?
Okay.
And you said something about the processors, but explain how that works.
Okay. There's an administrative assessment. Most like the federal orders have administrative assessment on processors, same situation. It's a maximum of 3.2 cents per 100 pounds of milk, which is about 3/10 on a cent on a gallon of milk. And the processors pay that directly.
And that's on top of the price that
otherwise.
Yes, 3 cents
per hundredweight is on top of the price.
Thank you.
Representative Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for coming out to Oregon. My question is kind of a broader question in terms of when the government should intervene in the market economy and how you would deal with the notion that we set precedents when we intervene, forming compacts, and how we would argue against, if we intervene here, how we would argue against other industries coming to us and our ability to be consistent and say, sometimes we just have to, and there's unfortunate consequences within the entire market, but sometimes we have to allow those forces to weave their way in and work themselves out.
Well, I mean, I would say what I said in the beginning, that that dairy industry is unique, and I'm sure every industry could claim its uniqueness, but in terms of how milk is produced, the techniques hasn't changed in 50 years, okay, or really forever. I mean, it's still perishable, it's still produced every day. I mean, you can't even, if you want to increase your milk production dramatically and put more cows on, it takes 2 years to do that. And milk is also a vital commodity. I mean, our consumers get very upset if they can't find milk in the store. If we have a snowstorm or something predicted and it runs out, I mean, that's a very serious problem in our area. So from those areas, we think that's important. I don't know how you answer for other commodities. I think this country is a shame what it does with its food policy. It's got a cheap food policy, which I guess is good for consumers, but it really doesn't look at the impacts on farmers and long-term policies. So I hate to say that we have to turn back to state governments to do this thing, but I think when we do that, if you turn to a commission and you bring all the people together, consumers, processors, supermarkets, all the groups, that's probably the best way to do it. The marketplace isn't working.
Representative Krupp, then Representative Rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was stated earlier by the gentleman from the president of the association that environmental cost is $1,000 per cow to comply with here on the west side of the Cascades. Do you have a similar cost figure? Do you have a cost figure in terms of compliance with environmental regulations in Europe?
I don't have it that, although we're running into more and more problems, particularly for manure storage and the like. Farmers, you know, we're having farmers milking 70 cows are going to have to make a $50,000 to $100,000 investment or more. That's the operating profit for that family for probably 4 years to make that change. So, yes, we see those problems coming down the road, and we're enthusiastic that the Compact Commission can have a public hearing and look at those facts and say, do we just tell our farmers to go away because of this issue, or can we look at it and factor that into some of the price impacts?
Thank you. Representative
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, kind of a follow-up to Representative Decker's question. We've already we have the federal government, the federal order system in place. Now, how long has it been in place?
Since 1937.
So we have a history of 50-some years with the government. Thank you for being precise. With the government being involved in this issue.
I have a question. If you're going to guarantee a price, how do you limit entry, so to speak, into your industry? Seems like if you had a guaranteed price, a guaranteed profits, that you would have a potential overproduction. The market's not working.
That's true, okay? And as an economist, that was a concern of mine. And that's why we structured the pricing of the compact as the commission did. We were the ones that went in there and supported this. The compact commission could give return to farmers every month, whether the price is high or low. It has that authority to do that, okay? But it chose to create a safety net. It triggers out whenever the price of milk in our area approaches about 14.50 a hundredweight. Our costs are probably a little higher than yours because of metropolitan areas or whatever, but I can't say. I don't know your cost structure. But when we get about to about 14.50, it triggers out. But it guarantees our farmers are not going to get below $13. We see that the average cost, the real average cost, I mean, there's all kinds of studies out there, is probably about a little between $15 and $16 for our farmers. If our farmers get $15 to $16 on a week, they're happy. Here it might be, maybe it's $14. Yes, probably a little less. So you wouldn't have to set the price as high. But it doesn't guarantee a profit. In fact, it just minimizes the loss. That's why we built that in. And it triggers in and out. Will we attract milk? In our compact, there's a 5-month waiting period to get into the compact. Okay? Because you have to show that you want to supply the market.
So now, is there some kind of limited entry into this?
No, only to the extent that you have to be supplying milk to the market for 5 months without a compact payment to show that you're a representative of it. And once you do that, you're in the compact. But keep in mind, if you're attracting milk from an area, for example, the last 7 months, they would have gotten nothing but had to pay the cost of supplying our market. Okay? So by having a safety net that triggers in and out, it's not a guarantee. It just isn't a guarantee for them. And so that's, at first, people jumped into our market. And afterwards, they said, wait a minute, why am I jumping in and paying these additional, you know, the farmers are paying additional hauling costs when I'm not getting that much. The amount of the compact isn't as important as when the compact payment is made. Okay? The compact payment has only averaged about between 40 and 50 cents a hundredweight to farmers over the last 2 years. That's not a tremendous amount. But in many months, it was zero when they didn't need it, and now it's going to be $1.44. And that's just saying, so that's helped us limit the attractiveness of the milk. But it, also the price level you set. You start attracting more milk, it means that your price may be too high. Maybe you've got to ratchet down. Our contact commission hasn't changed the price in 2 years, even though me as a farmer advocate would have liked that.
Because we had the federal buyout program to try to get dairy farmers out of the business because we had too many dairy farmers, and so I was wondering if we put a guaranteed price so that everybody makes money. It's been my experience in agriculture, if there's any money to be made, everybody jumps in and kills it.
I agree 100%, but that's why we don't have a guaranteed price. We look at cost of production, and we take the very bottom out when farmers are hurt the worst. But you're right. We can't guarantee them cost of production or above, or we're going to create those problems. The Compact Commission doesn't do that.
Mr. Chairman, I might just call your attention. This is Dave Nelson again for the record. On page 11 of the amendments on subsection F, it says specifically that when establishing a compact order over order price, the commission shall, it's not may, it says shall, take action as necessary and feasible to ensure that the compact over order price does not create an incentive for producers to generate additional supplies of milk.
I think we have one more question, and I want to bring up the next witnesses, their testimony. Representative Crumble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does the federal order system work?
It helps set a very bare bones bottom. I think it's important to have it because it coordinates prices nationally, but by itself, no, it doesn't. It doesn't address farmers' key issues.
Yeah, one quick follow-up. So, so it sort of works, but it doesn't really. Why not attempt to fix that system as opposed to having these regional compacts?
We attempted to do that in 1990. I had proposals under the federal order, and they decided that they did not want to do that. We also looked at that, I believe, a little over a year ago down in Washington. We tried to put a national floor under the federal order system, and that was rejected.
Mr. Chair, just to expand on that answer, I think the milk politics in Washington, D.C. are generally dominated by Minnesota and Wisconsin.
Representative Byer, one quick question, then I'll bring up the grocery industry.
Okay. I don't know exactly how to phrase my question here. You say you're only setting a minimum price, and then it only kicks in when market orders are below that, but yet, in reality, isn't the market conditions the federal minimum?
Yes, but it's market conditions on a national basis, particularly out in the upper Midwest. Your production could fall 20%, but if the upper Midwest production went up 3%, your farm price would collapse, and there's nothing you could do about it. That's the problem.
One more then, Mr. Chair.
Representative Byron.
Well, if in fact the market condition is the national price, and the compact says that the compact is a regional price, and we're taking a regional things into account, and that's why the compact price is going to be higher than the national price. What happens? What's the rationale then to say that when the market price, or the i.e. federal minimum price, is above the regional price, that the milk price should go up? Then it seems to me like we said that this is the amount that the dairy farmers in Oregon or in Washington or in the Northeast need to get, to because of environmental conditions, feed conditions, you know, local conditions. What's the rationale then to say, well, now that the national price is higher, that's what we want now?
Well, if you did that, then you need to try to peg your price to the exact cost of production and pay that every month. The compact doesn't do that. The compact only triggers in when it's well below, and then it tries it. As soon as it even comes within 50 cents to a dollar a hundredweight, it starts to trigger out. I mean, in fact, it goes away within that level because it's not trying to dictate what the price is and the cost. Every farmer has a different cost. So we try to keep it below the cost of all farmers. You could do that if you wanted to do that, but we think it's better just to provide a safety net and let farmers, you know, live on the roller coaster. It's part of the market. Farmers are very free market oriented. We're just trying to take out the very bottom. it's different than trying to mandate a price, everybody gets paid, and sort of like social engineering. We're just trying to take out a, like, provide a very minimum wage.
Yeah, thank you. We need to bring up, we'll maybe have you back here and get some more questions.
Mr. Chairman, could I just make a couple of comments in conclusion that I would like to call your attention to page 23 of the proposed amendment, where we added specificity to the membership of the Oregon delegation to the compact, which does include, is dominated by others, and there's one dairy farmer, there's a consumer representative from a public nutrition program, and there's a representative of distributors, producers, and retailers, and so they could get together and clearly outvote the farmer. Then on your fiscal impact, I notice you have a fiscal legislative fiscal. I think they I would represent to you that I think that they misread the compact and the way that the compact operates, and they indicate that there would be, that there could be a price increase limit in excess of $1 per gallon. You know, that's the total price that the farmers are getting today, and we're not going to, there's no way that the compact doubles the price of milk to the farmers at all. And so I think that fiscal really needs to be looked at with a grain of salt, and I think that the legislative fiscal needs to understand how the compact works. Thank you.
Do we have that fiscal? You had a copy on there a while ago.
I think we handed them out earlier.
Samantha, do you have any there?
I think with that, we have Steve McCoy and Kent Chris and Jim Head. I tell all three of you come on up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Steve McCoy, here representing the Oregon Grocery Industry Association. We're here in opposition to these proposed amendments to Senate Bill 1212. In opening up, I would like to say we oppose these for a couple of reasons. We think, primarily, first of all, on a philosophical basis, we think this flies in the face of the free enterprise system. We don't. I represent an industry where every day, well, back in the 16 years I've been there, literally hundreds of small independent grocers have gone out of business for very much the same reasons. We operate in one of the most competitive industries in the world, where our net profit after taxes traditionally is right at 1 cent on the dollar. We have seen literally hundreds of independents in Oregon go out of business in the last 15, 20 years, and they did it not because they weren't good businessmen. In most cases, they did it because they were smaller, maybe a little undercapitalized, and frankly, the way the market forces have gone, those folks that are better capitalized and running bigger stores and bigger operations can offer better prices, more services to the customer, and the people in Oregon have voted with their feet and their wallets by shopping at those stores, and the result is that some of the small guys have gone away. At the same time, we were not here hat in hand asking any way we could sit down as a group and sit down and protect our profit margins and perhaps boost them to protect those small guys. My folks have believers in the free enterprise system, and then you battle out and do the best you can and hopefully find a niche market. And if you can't, you know, you're going to go the way of some of these small guys, and that's the way of the world. I'd also point out that in this area, you can point at about any industry and you see the consolidation, be it insurance, be it banks, be it cable TV, be it, point at something that where it isn't, the big guys are getting bigger and the small guys are not being able to compete and going away. And in all those cases, you don't have government intervention stepping in to guarantee them a profit and a means and a way to survive in the marketplace. That just simply isn't the way, in my opinion and our members' opinion, that our economy in this nation has been built and survived. So on a philosophical basis, we oppose this. the same time, our members also see themselves, and as a somebody who started out in the wholesale business as a grocery buyer and spent his first 10 years of almost a 30-year career as a buyer, working every day to make sure I got the best prices for the products that we sold to those independent retailers and chains throughout the state in those days. I know that we pride ourselves on making sure that we provide quality products at the best price we can provide to our customers. And we see this proposal as a direct threat of our ability to do that. It's going to take away our ability to go to the market in case the price gets too high to buy product that's just as high quality, but at a lower price that we can then offer to our consumers and your constituents at the best price available. This takes that ability away from us, clearly. I've got some testimony here that we can run through with some charts that I'll explain as we go along. Let's try to go through them quickly. As I've said, some of the issues we've got here, we don't think this is equitable. In fact, we think it's inequitable that the large dairy farmers are going to receive significantly greater benefits than the small folks that this is purportedly supposed to help. We think it's ineffective because, as I said, it's not going to prevent small family farms from leaving dairy farming and agriculture. We think it's bad politics. It's going to impose new, in effect, from our point of view, is a tax that's going to go be levied on the consumers of this state every time they buy a gallon of milk at the retail level. And make sure you understand, this deals with fluid milk only. This does not deal with milk used to produce dairy products and or cheese or powdered milk. This deals solely with the fluid milk consumed by Oregonians. It's going to undercut welfare reform and nutrition programs. We undercuts our free enterprise system, and we think it's going to drive down ultimately with higher prices the consumption of milk. And finally, we don't think it's necessary. The milk is in plentiful supply in the Northwest region. Oregon's dairy farmers currently have, and we'll talk about this because this hasn't come up yet, a Northwest Milk Marketing Federation to offset market fluctuations and raise their income that they receive for their milk above the federal market order level. Now, it controls milk produced solely in Washington and Oregon and not in the outside the compact area, however. So those are some of the reasons. And going quickly, we've got dairy compacts, increased production and reduced consumption. Higher compact prices will stimulate milk production, depress demand for milk in the compact region. Conversion of the local milk surplus into cheese, butter, and milk powder will drive down prices for these products in the compact and non-compact regions. The 1997-98 New England milk powder surplus drove down U.S. prices and forced government purchases of the excess production, thus affecting all dairy farmers inside and outside the compact area. And I've got some charts that I attached there. Just to show you, and this is based on U.S. consumption, and the retail prices and the retail sales movement that this is derived from is from the A.C. Nielsen Company, which basically buys the sales tapes of supermarkets throughout the country. So these are actual sales by unit that they compare versus a year ago. And if you look at number one, and I apologize, it's not in color there, but the upper part of the chart shows the price, the fluid milk price going up. And you can see it's by the month there. It goes up basically every month. And on the lower side, you can see that the consumption versus the same month a week ago, or a year ago or a year previously has dropped. And consistently, the consumption drops as the price goes up. We think that it's just a supply and demand. As prices go up, consumption drops on most issues. We bring that just to for your consideration, and I guess to prove our point to a degree.
Mr. Chair. Representative Crummell.
Thank you. With regards to the chart, are those retail prices and not wholesale prices?
Yes. Retail price increases, volume goes down.
So what has happened with the wholesale price?
Well, the retail price, and we'll discuss that, but basically as the price went up through 98 and into the early 99, as that price went up, it drove retail prices up, and the result was consumption went down. But those are, Mr. Chair and Representative Palmer, those are retail prices that we're comparing. They're not a whole, not the farm market price. Participation in a dairy compact will not slow the loss of dairy farms. I refer you to chart number two. The vast majority of farms that have given up dairy farming since 1982 have been farms with less than 50 cows. These farms generally would receive only a few thousand dollars a year from the dairy compact, hardly enough to ensure their continued viability. The compact has not helped this issue a great deal in New England. 1 year after the compact began, New England dairy farms went out of business at a 41% faster rate than the two prior years. You look at chart number two, and again, July of 95, 3,520 dairy farms in the New England region. That was a change from between 795 and 696 to July of 96. There is a 4.3% change, a drop in the number of farms to 3,367. You can see in July of 97, it drops to 3,267, which is a 3.69% drop. July of 97 is when the New England Compact went into effect, and the change from July of 97 to June of 98 was 5.8%, down to 3,000 of these small farms. So while it did increase the price paid, it did not slow the rate of decline of these small farms. And again, I would say that I think that's indicative of the economy in general, where the big guys are able to compete better, be it dairy farms, be it grocery stores, be it banks, be it anybody else. Compacts impose what we're calling a tax on the milk drinking public. By authorizing a compact, the legislature is effectively imposing a new tax on their constituents. It falls most heavily on lower income families who have the least ability to absorb increased costs of milk. Now, chart number three, and I want to make clear here what we did here when we developed this chart, and I did this with my national association. They made an assumption that is not accurate, and I want to make sure to clear that up. They made an assumption that the price would increase the New England price of $16.94 from an Oregon base of $15 when we did this. The legislation or the amendment before you would set a ceiling of $15 a hundredweight and then tie it to the consumer price index, subject to some discussions among the compact commission on how far they wanted to, if they wanted to follow it up three or five, whatever the inflation rate was, or give them maybe a lower price. So these are overstated based on that. This would be a 24 cent a gallon increase at the retail level. What that cost would be to consumers is $18.8 million. Obviously, if it went up 12 cents a gallon, it would be less than that. But this gives you a flavor for the price that's going to be paid by Oregonians for their fluid milk cost. But again, it's based on raising the price from $15 to $16.94, which is the New England compact price right now.
Steve, do retail prices follow the farm price?
I can jump ahead if you want, Chair. We've got the last graph here. We pull that one out. We'll just skip to that one. There's going to be a discussion on this, and this was became a little bit of a discussion item on the Senate side. This colored graph here, I think, is the last one. That is a two-colored graph here. Again, this is for Washington and Oregon retail prices for the last 2 years, from January of 97 to January of 99. You can see the sort of maroon or violet or whatever that color is there. On the bottom is the Northwest Class 1 farm price. And to make sure we get this all aligned right, on the left side in 15-cent increments in a 90-cent price range are the retail prices. On the right side of that chart, to overlay it so you can track them, are the Farm One class prices, also in 15-cent increments and a 90-cent spread. Just make sure we're not, so you understand what we get this graph. So the bottom set of standards with the square blocks, you can see the price fluctuates up and down, and you see a real steep increase towards the end of from July of 98 to January of 98-9, which is when is the previous testimony indicated, when the price got that high, was, I've been informed, record high levels for the federal market order pricing, is when the New England compact price triggered out, I guess was the phrase that was used, where it got high enough where they were not paying anything into the compact price because the actual market price was high enough you didn't need to. So I'm making that clear. That's where that steep rise is there. But, excuse me.
We have a question. Representative Obrador.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. But the price has fallen substantially by April. Is that not correct? You show the January.
Mr. Chair, yeah, Representative Herbalot, yes, it has. These were the numbers that were available to me from the AC Nielsen data.
You have the April price?
I don't have it with me, no. But I'll be glad to try and provide that to you. But this is for a 2-year period what we received. And then on the top again is the blue color is the retail price. And you can see, while it's not completely, it definitely follows up and down with the market. Now, the contention is, and you'll see, I think, in testimony that was on the Senate side, that the whole spread is somehow the retailer's responsibility between the price the farmer's receiving and the retail price. And we would say that there's also included in there, you got transportation costs, you got production costs, you got marketing costs, you got distribution costs to the retail store before that retail is applied. So while there's a spread of about a buck and a half here, eyeballing this between the market order farm price and the retail price, it stays pretty steady for that 2-year period. If you look at it, it's about a buck and a half. That might be subject for discussion, but you're going to have to dissect a little more than to lay the whole dollar and a half spread on the retailer's back, because the retailer is not the only person in this equation. Again, there's distribution, transportation, marketing, production costs, distribution costs out to the stores included in that spread.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. McCoy, where does AC Nielsen get its data from?
Chair Wells, Representative Crummell, AC Nielsen gets its data from the scanning records or tapes that the supermarkets, from the scanning records of the supermarkets. So it's the actual sales volume, both from a sales volume standpoint and from a pricing standpoint. That occurred at the check stand. One of the issues on the Senate side became the price. One of the things we have in Oregon is what we call a high-low market. In other words, we tend to have higher shelf prices in the Oregon market since I've been in it in the early 70s. And we also have low ad prices. And one of the products that is frequently advertised in this market is milk. It's something that obviously attracts people. A large percentage of the customers come in looking for milk. And, you know, in the last month, and just tracking it, we had Fred Meyer with 99-cent coupon for a gallon of milk for the month of April. We've had Roth's here in the local area two times in the last 6 weeks with milk at 99 cents a gallon. We've had Safeway several times in the last month and a half to 2 months with a one free with one when you buy a gallon of milk. So that gets factored into the AC Nielsen mix, where the chart you're going to see coming up from the proponents of the bill is going to take the same prices, but it's a USDA shelf price where they check three stores in the Portland metro area, a chain store, an independent supermarket, a convenience store once a month, take three prices, divided by three, and they're applying that as the average retail price in the market. This is actually all the subscribing supermarkets, as all major supermarkets in the states, actual price that was paid at the check stand, factoring in ad sales and discounts and special discounts, as well as the everyday regular shelf price.
I think we need to move ahead here. Okay. Chris.
Mr. Chair, if I'd make one more point, and then you can read this as well as I can. The one thing I would really like to talk about on the last page is the fact that what's in existence now, and it wasn't discussed previously, is a Northwest Milk Marketing Federation that's in existence now. It allows the producers in Washington and Oregon, and 98% of them are members, to increase the price over the federal market order price that they're receiving for milk currently. And currently, it's my understanding, talking to one of the processors, that they're at $15 a hundredweight, which is what this bill would set the ceiling at. The Milk Marketing Federation, the difference between that and the compact is the Milk Marketing Federation is controlling the price of milk produced only in Washington and Oregon by the members in the federation. That gives my members and the processors and the retailers the ability, if the price gets too high, is set too high, to go outside the market, use a free enterprise system, purchase milk perhaps in Idaho and truck it in, and if they can do that, adding transportation costs in,
at a lower price, they can keep the price of milk lower to their customers. What in actuality happens is because you've got that competitive balance going on, the Federation tends to set the price above the market order, but at the point where it's still about the same cost to truck it in from outside area as it is to purchase it in-state. So while they're getting a premium for their over the federal market order price for their milk, it's still a different issue than the compact, which would basically set a parameter where if they set the price at $15 a hundredweight and the market was at 11, and we went to buy milk and truck it in from Idaho, and it cost, as I'll put something on because I'm not sure, $1.50 a hundredweight, so it's $12.50. The minute it hit the border of this compact into the compact area, you have to pay the $2.50 difference between $12.50 and $15 to the commission to be redistributed to the farmers. In other words, it takes the ability from the free enterprise point of view for our members to go out and buy lower price milk to provide to the consumers of Oregon. And it's basically a price fixing mechanism with the compact that they're asking for when they already have an ability to increase their profits and increase their income, I should say, over the federal market earning price with their marketing federation. It's a very important point. They've got an ability now to control the production of the milk in Washington and Oregon. They've got that ability, and they're doing it, and they have been doing it for about 2 years. In the last number seven attachment here, there's a copy of an article from the Business Journal quoting the executive director of the Federation. They distributed $5 million to their members in 1998, and he anticipates distributing $15 to $20 million in added income to those to the dairy farmers in Washington and Oregon in 1999. So the mechanism is in place. They've got the ability to do this right now. They're trying to lock it in where there's no way we can go outside the area and sort of keep them in a competitive balance.
Let's hear from your other people here, Steve. We're running out of time here.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representatives, for the record, my name is Kent Chris. I'm a category manager for Fred Meyer and responsible for managing several product lines for our food division, one being the merchandising of our commercial dairy plant in Swan Island. My expertise is from the retailing side, not from the production side. Our Swan Island dairy plant is located in Portland. It services all of our Fred Meyer and Quality Food Center stores in Oregon, Washington, and Alaska. Fred Meyer employs over 20,000 people in Northwest Alaska markets. As previously stated by Steve McCoy, formation of a dairy compact will increase production and reduce consumption. Higher compact prices will stimulate milk production and depress demand for milk in the compact region. Higher costs will ultimately result in higher retails. Depending upon the height of those retails, milk sales will fall as customers look for other less expensive alternatives. In addition, higher costs will not allow retailers to actively promote liquid dairy products. In food retailing, your milk customer is generally referred to as your best customer. Due to the tremendous draw that milk has with our customers, when costs are down, retailers more actively promote, frequently at retails that are well below their costs. This translates into increased customer traffic, increased milk sales, but substantial real dollar loss to the retailer. Steve brought up the fact that of the advertising that myself and our competitors have done recently. This is an ad that we ran 5 weeks that ran through the month, the first part of May, and I apologize for the fact that the coupon is not here. Obviously, someone felt the need to have that. But he pointed out the price point, and it was very, very substantial, very impactful to the consumer. Higher prices will reduce retailers' everyday sales, eliminate advertising, and lower the demand for milk production. Fred Meyer strongly opposes the approval of Senate Bill 129.
Thank you. Nice to have you here today. Jim Head.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss Safeway's point of view of this amendment to Senate Bill 1212. My name is Jim Head. I'm the plant manager of Safeway's milk plant in Clackamas, and I'm here today to discuss our views on this amendment. I've been with Safeway for 28 years, and I manage the milk plant in Clackamas. We supply all of the yogurt and sour cream for all the Safeway stores from Seattle to Phoenix to Denver and to Washington, D.C. So we utilize quite a bit of this milk in the Oregon area. Safeway also has another plant in Myrtle Point and three dairy and ice cream plants in Washington. We purchase raw milk from independent dairy farmers and cooperatives, dairy farmers. In total, over 10,000 Oregonians are employed by Safeway. Here are a few of the reasons why Safeway is opposed to regional price-fixing compacts in the passage of this Senate Bill 1212. The compact is not needed to ensure a high-quality local supply of fresh milk. This is the Federal Market Administrator's March report, and it says producers delivered a total of 584.4 million pounds of milk to the market during March, an increase of 27.9 million pounds from the level a year ago. Daily deliveries increased 1.2% from previous month and 5% above the level a year ago. An estimated 1,100 producers delivered milk averaging 16,968 pounds, an increase of 1,439 pounds, or 9.3% a year ago. Oregon and Washington are awash in milk. It's been stated before that we're a deficit state. We are not a deficit state. As you can see, less than one-third of the total milk is used for beverage milk going into the bottle. 30 years ago, 70% of the milk was used for fluid products. Clearly, a compact is not necessary. A compact is not necessary to ensure Oregon and Washington dairy farmers a fair return. Last year, Oregon and Washington farmers formed the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation. And I think it was the chair that said earlier, when prices go up, sometimes we're our own worst enemy. One of our dairy farmers said, if we get this thing passed, and they passed the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation last year, and all the farmers, 98% of them joined, he said, you know, if we were smart, Jim, as soon as we pass this, we would decrease production by 5%. Well, as you can see, production went up as we formed the Northwest Milk Marketing Federation. The purpose of the organization, as Steve said, is to establish a minimum price of $15 a hundredweight, ensuring dairy farmers a fair return. All fluid milk handlers in Oregon and Washington have agreed to pay the price set by the NMF as long as it does not exceed $15 a hundredweight. Compacts impose taxes on milk-drinking consumers and hurt the poor. Plain and simple, the Northeast Compact has cost New England consumers $47 million in higher milk prices since its inception in July of 1997. Consumers, especially those in fixed incomes, should not have to bear the brunt of this regressive tax. The increase in milk prices has significantly reduced consumption in the compact area. Dairy compacts undercut our free enterprise system. Dairy compacts are price-fixing cartels that have a single purpose, to inflate the price of fluid milk by preventing the entry of lower-cost milk from efficient farmers in other states and have no place in our economy. Milk prices should be determined by the competitive free market where all segments of the dairy industry can work towards what should be the common goal of increasing sales of wholesome dairy products to our consumers. The amendment to Senate Bill 1212 is an impediment to accomplishing that goal. Safeway would hope members of the committee would agree with this conclusion and not support the passage of Senate Bill 1212.
I think what we're going to do, members, is hold this over to Thursday. Because, I don't think we're ready to make a decision yet. We have a couple of people signed up here from Oregon Dairy Farmers. I guess that's Oregon Dairy Farmers. And that's Don Moisson. Would that be all right, Dave? I think we need to, we have to get to the floor. And we appreciate everyone coming. I guess I have one quick question. Why didn't the Grocery Association approve this compact in the New England when it was put in? That was testimony. It says they were stayed neutral.
Mr. Chair, I can call back there and find out. I don't have an answer for that.
But they don't.
I know nationally that these have been consistently opposed by our national association, but I don't have an answer for that.
Mr. Chair, will either one of the gentlemen from the two retailers be back Thursday? If you're not, I have a quick question for you.
Go ahead.
Do either one of you import milk from other countries and or states?
I can't answer that question because I don't deal with questions.
Okay.
And you, we all bring it in from Washington.
Okay.
I guess with that, we'll close the hearing on Senate Bill 1212, and we'll see you Thursday. Thank you, everyone.